Hey, it's Tobias here. If you want to learn a little bit about my firm or see my portfolio, head on over to acquirersfunds.com. Hi, I'm Tobias Carlisle. This is the Acquirers Podcast. My special guests today are Steve Bishop and Patrick Fisher of Elite Wine and Whiskey. We're going to be talking about storing and investing in wine and whiskey right after this.
Tobias Carlisle is the founder and principal of Acquirers Funds. For regulatory reasons, he will not discuss any of the Acquirers Funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Acquirers Funds or affiliates. For more information, visit acquirersfunds.com.
Steve, can you tell me a little bit about Elite Wine and Whiskey? What is it?
Hi, thanks for having us today. Basically, Elite Wine and Whiskey is a small company based in London. We pretty much help customers, collectors to purchase fine wine and whiskey casks. A lot of our customers are predominantly collectors. They have a passion for alcohol. It's something that's it's an interest to them. It's something that they've sort of have an understanding and enjoy the market. And more so recently, it's been a lot of whiskey collecting, which has been something that's become a huge part of our company, especially over the last 18 months. There's been a lot of talk around whiskey casks. It's been on the news. People have understood how well it's actually done. And I think because of the pandemic with COVID, people have I've been looking outside your normal remit area as well. So we've had a lot of inquiries and a lot of new customers have come on board with us over the last couple of years.
So you're the investment grade wine specialist between you and Patrick, who focuses more on the whiskey. Yep. Can you just tell me a little bit about what's the process for investing in wine with you? How does that work?
So on the wine side, we deal with what we would call as fine wine, which takes up sort of 0.2% of the actual annual growth of production of wine. There's something, a law called Appellation Contrôlée, which allows chateaus, especially more so in Bordeaux, where we predominantly focus our attention. Appellation Contrôlée only allows these chateaus in France to produce a certain amount of wine each year. So dependent on the weather, dependent on the grape and the harvest that year, then of course wines get graded from different critiques. If they have scores of anywhere really sort of over 90 and above, that's where we sort of pay our attentions. There's a growthing system in Bordeaux as well. So you have your first growth, which is made up of five wines, big wines like Latour, Lafite Rothschild, Mouton Rothschild. And then the tiering system goes down. So really, we would say that your Bordeaux, your Premier Cru, your big wines are your safe bets where a lot of people would focus their attentions. But it doesn't mean that every year is going to be a good year. Of course, some years, if the weather isn't great and they haven't been able to produce the best of stock, then of course, it's a year that we won't focus our attention on. We might sort of pay our attentions elsewhere to maybe Italy, Rome, California, and just basically try and keep our finger on the pulse to make sure that we're giving our customers the best chance to make good capital growth on their money, basically.
What's the California wines that you watch?
California has been interesting over the last couple of years, really, really interesting. And it's actually been quite hard to call because I love California wine. I think basically Bordeaux wine is very heavy. It's number one, basically. Bordeaux, France are known for having the most amazing wines. But California, I think they've done really well with their marketing over the last couple of years as well. And because it's a slightly lighter wine, mostly made up of Cab Sav, I think with the way they've marketed themselves, they've tried to tap into the younger audience, which I think they've done extremely well. A lot of their wine bottles and their labels are quite quirky, something that's slightly different. But it's been hard to call because, of course, we've had a lot of bad weather in California over the last couple of years as well. We've had the horrific scenes with the fires. Of course, there's been a lot of droughts over there. So it's been difficult, and the fact of that it's actually sometimes improved grape quality on the fact that the grapes are actually drying out, but also at the same time, it's limited the amount of production they could do as well. And there's been certain wines where we put our customers into big stock, like Screaming Eagles, Highland Estates, Opus Ones, Dominus, real big hitting California wines, but not all of them have performed as well as we would have liked, which is quite strange. But we're members of something called LiveX, which is a main trading platform for fine wine. And there was a recent article basically saying that California wine is now taking up nearly 17% of trade. So it's taken up more of people's interest. And I think it's something that I think if people looked at it as a longer hold, a 5-10 year hold in the Californian, they would do extremely well.
How did you get started as a wine guy?
Okay, so without sounding like an alcoholic, I enjoy my alcohol. I like wine. I like whiskey. Since meeting Pat, I've been fortunate enough to try some fantastic whiskies, and we've travelled to Scotland a couple of times and had some amazing experiences. I think as an individual, I have an interest in like property. I have an interest in sort of cars. I like tangible assets, things that you can collect, things that you can actually touch and feel. And I've always found that with wine, there's a lot behind it. There's a lot with whiskey that goes on behind the scenes. There's a lot of heritage. It has a story to it. It's exciting. There's a lot there. So I used to be involved in property, and I had some friends that introduced me to wine. It's something now I've been involved in the last 15 years. And I just really enjoy it. It's something that you can share with friends, and there's a lot of conversation all the time. And me and Pat have many, many, many conversations over wine, over whiskey. And it's something that you can celebrate with friends, and it will always be at your tables, at your celebrations. It's something that I enjoy talking about.
And Pat, in whiskey, how did you first get started in it? Is it a birthright because you're Scottish?
Yeah, basically you're just taught it at school. It's just part of your pathway into growing up through teenage years. Here's your choice: be a fireman, a postman, or enjoy whiskey. No, it's just one of those things that I sort of got pulled to. When I first graduated university, I went to work for the world's largest brewer, InBev, who owned Budweiser, Stella, Beck's, Whole Garden. And then progressed into distilling. And then obviously with the natural pull to Scotland and understanding distilling and putting together products and some of the pains that distilleries have to go through, which, you know, it's hand craftsmanship making whiskey. Found my pathway into whiskey and being able to have a nice life where I get to spend a couple of weeks each month up in Scotland and seeing my family, and also have my life down in England with my own family and enjoy, you know, having a foot in both camps, if you like. And that's how I got started.
Can you give us an overview of what the sort of investment grade whiskey world looks like?
An incredibly diverse place. Where there is an entry and access point for anybody that would look to invest in whiskey to generate a revenue back to them and profit, or to do it as a passion with a love and a desire that they wanted to have their own cask of whiskey and bottle it for themselves. It is such a dynamic, fast-moving market right now, whiskey investment. You have a lot of distilleries are pulling back their main name brands from the marketplace because they want to try and control the release of the product themselves. So they don't want it to end up in the hands of any old Tom, Dick and Harry or independent bottlers who will release a different age expression or a different cask expression to what they would want to have out in the market. You have the other continuous moving parts, which is you have got older brands that have been undervalued, finding their new fan base as they have had rebrands, and then the value just suddenly shoots up overnight. You have got this industry of whiskey, which you know, is hundreds of years old, and distilleries that have stood there for, you know, generations on generations, which have now moved from being shrouded in secrecy to having the curtain pulled open and are now owned by huge multinational companies, from the Diageos of the world to the Edrington Groups of the world to the Nika Whiskies of the world to the Pernod Ricards of the world. And it has become an incredibly professional business where every distillery is open in some way or another to the public, where these global giants of companies are spreading the good word of whiskey near all over the world, near and far. And they are global monsters now. And that is part of why whiskey investment has become such a huge success for people. And forgive me if I'm talking too much here, but it is the good news stories that you have seen on the BBC, Forbes, The Telegraph, The Times, The Mail, big mainstream publications, writing about people generating huge returns on their investments through whiskey. And that has been driven by the professionalism that's been brought into the industry, where these global companies have thrown billions of pounds at distilleries with 10, 15, 20, 50 year projects in mind to generate the return on profit for all those billions. And if companies like that are investing so heavily into the whiskey industry, then they're not doing it to not generate profit for their shareholders. And of course, if you then get along and you buy a piece of that investment through a cask and not a share in the company, then you can pick up all that hard work that they're doing and rebrands, branding, selling to further afield, generating more new expressions, bringing new drinkers to the market. And you sit on that cask for 5, 10, 15 years, you see the benefit of not just with whiskey, which is different to wine, where you can see on the internet or in a supermarket the difference between a 10-year-old bottle of, let's say, a Macallan versus a 25-year-old bottle, and you can judge the price gap. And you can see that over time on all the various outlets where you can buy whiskey. You can judge at which point you would want to sell it because you can see that price difference. And then you can track it across the years you own a cask with the year-on-year inflation that's put on, with the year-on-year price increase. So most years, a distillery will release a 10-year-old expression, for example, of a whiskey, but it won't stay at the same price. The distillery will put an extra few pounds on the price of a bottle. And of course, that then is putting up the price of each and every different release, 18-year-old, 15-year-old, 20-year-old, as it kicks on further down the chain, which in turn means you can see, okay, if I buy this 10-year-old cask now and I sit on it for 10 years and it's released to the 20-year-old whiskey, I can see what that price increase would look like. But if you're sitting on it for 10 years, you have to then factor in there will be inflationary increases. You will then get the increase year on year from the distillery increasing the price of their bottle, which is obviously part of them investing into their business. They want to generate bigger profits. And of course, you might get lucky and get behind the brand, but one of the massive global companies takes and makes into something bigger than whiskey and makes it a brand itself, like Macallan has done with the Macallan, which is now viewed as similar terms as Rolex, Ferrari, Apple. And you could pick something up that's undervalued and really cheap just now. But then, as you know, as we've seen with, and the most recent example being Royal Bracklaw, which is owned by Bacardi, beautiful whiskey, great whiskey. Nobody really knew too much about it. Didn't have great traction. Bacardi done an incredible rebrand that they worked on for 3 years, released different expressions, different age statements, different cask expressions. And the value of the same whiskey a year ago is almost 50% more in terms of just the bottle price from the new releases that they've done with Royal Bracklaw. Now everybody wants Royal Bracklaw, and the value of casks doubled nearly overnight because as soon as the rebrand came out, everyone's like, God, that's amazing. And this new sherry 18-year-old expression is, how have I never known about Royal Bracklaw? Now I know all about Royal Bracklaw. And then of course, when they do these releases, they have plans to distribute it, you know, further afield in the Far East or America or you know, big campaigns and duty free as and when travel returns to normal with COVID. And that's certainly been seen with Royal Brackler. So that's a very broad brushstroke approach. And sorry if I have, you know, bored you there with some of the dynamics, I guess, of the whiskey market right now. But I hope that does give a good overall picture of what's happening in the whiskey investment market and, you know, why it has become such an exciting, dynamic place to be right now.
Steve, there have been some attempts over the last few decades to like quantitatively predict what the value of a bottle will be over time, because I understand that when you first drink, when the wine is first cast, it's very raw and it's hard to kind of determine even the very good ones, which will be the better ones. And so they've tried to come up with these other mechanisms for valuing these bottles, and it's looking at the amount of rain that falls. Has that penetrated the industry at all? Do you look at those things? Do you rely on them?
I think there's a lot of critiques, and there's a handful that really sort of have a big influence on the wine market. All wines are tasted from barrel to start with and given a rough score of maybe sort of, say, if it was out of 100, then of course they might taste the wine from barrel and say, look, anywhere between sort of 90 to 93 points or 94 to 97 points, and you can get a rough gauge. There's been some exceptional years recently, some not so exceptional years, and you do sometimes, I don't ever like to use the word punt, because of course we do have people that buy wine because they enjoy the they don't just look at it as a moneymaker. They will look at it as something they're collecting. We've got a lot of our customers that might say, look, we'll take sort of three or four cases or something, knowing that they'll sit on two cases for 10 years to sell, and that the profit they've made will pretty much then pay for the first two, and the second two cases will be just all profit. So it depends. A lot of our customers, they look at it as just, some of them are just as a bit of fun, if I'm honest with you. Some of them, it's just a passion. It's something they really enjoy. They enjoy drinking wine. We've had, it's been ups and downs. We follow a lot of things on LiveX as well. LiveX is the main trading platform for fine wine. So there's about 450 merchants that are members of LiveX globally. So there's a lot of buying and selling that goes on LiveX. We can track the indices. We can see what wines are selling more often than others. We can see what's popular. We can see if there's any bids, live bids on certain wines. So we can see daily what vintages, what years are getting a lot more attention than others. And we don't always get it right. Trust, like we try to always get it right. We've had certain wines and certain vintages that we've put customers' money into. We said, look, this looks like it's going to do extremely well. And it's been a little bit of a slow burner. Some of them have taken a couple of years before there's been any real growth. We might have seen a percent or two growth on an annual basis, and it hasn't been as good as we wanted. But there's been others where they've received scores, they've received high scores, and then they've been upgraded, and then we've seen sort of 10, 15, 20% uplift on annually. So we just have to keep our finger on the pulse as much as possible, really.
Is there a great deal of variability from vintage to vintage? Are the better winemakers able to sort of control it, or is it it really is dictated by the weather or whatever it is that prevails at the time, and then you don't really know what you've got for, you know, 10 or 15 years or however long you're expected to sell it?
I think if you stick with the big branded, your Bordeaux's, the Burgundies have been absolutely phenomenal over the last sort of 10, 15 years. Burgundies have done really, really, really well. If you was to purchase a case of, say, DRC, Romani Conti, and you sit on it for the next sort of 10, 15 years, you're not really going to go too far wrong. It's just inevitable. You don't really get bad names with a DRC. If you was lucky enough to get Petrus, where there's only sort of a few thousand cases made every single year, and there's people on the waiting list to visit Petrus. If you get your hands on a Petrus, you know over time it's just going to do well. Of course, you can't keep these things for some of these wines for too long. We've had stories where, like Lafitte Rothschild 1982, it was at one point trading for sort of £200-300 a case when it was first bought out in 1982. Robert Parker, the most famous wine critic of all, gave the Lafite 82 100 points out of 100. Everyone said he was crazy. It's not 100-point wine. And in 2010, the Lafite Rothschild 1982 was actually traded for £50,000. Okay. But retraction on that, and then the score did come down to 98 points out of 100, and the wine now has started to come down slowly in value. So that £50,000 case has started coming down. It's, I think it's around about sort of £32,000-£33,000. So there is a right time to sell. You can overhold on wine as well, which is something that you don't do with whiskey. With whiskey, you can just keep holding. Of course, there is a time when, with the whiskey, we would recommend to actually bottle it before the ABV and alcohol content comes down too low. But with wine, yeah, I'd say sort of a 10-year hold is a very, very good hold in wine. And you know, if you hold something for 10 years, you should be in good stead.
Pat, does whiskey suffer from that same problem with the variability between the vintages, or because it's the process is so controlled that they're able to get much more consistency from year to year?
I mean, you've hit the nail on the head right there. As a much more controlled process these days. 30, 40 years ago, there was more variation because it was so dependent upon the casks and where they were stored and what the bonded warehouse looks like and which part of the bonded warehouse they were in. And the climate, if Scotland suddenly had a hot summer, evaporation rates would go up and various factors that all came into play before, the big monster companies came and took over and brought in this degree and level of professionalism now, which gives the whole whiskey market the stability that it's always craved. You can pick up a bottle of 25, 30-year-old, 35-year-old whiskey from any of the main distilleries, and it will always, within a varying degree, taste the same. And that is what has drawn more and more people to whiskey investment, because with the big global companies owning most of the major distilleries now in Scotland, it's not only secured all the distilleries' futures, because they have been standing for hundreds of years, and they are the Diageos of the world, the Bacardis, they are just treating them as custodians and passing them on. But they have invested heavily into cask programs so that the wood that's in the cask is the same throughout, whether it's bourbon barrels, port barrels, sherry barrels, refill bourbon, virgin oak, which gives you the consistency. All the bonded warehouses now are all temperature controlled, so it doesn't matter which part of the bonded warehouse the casks are sitting in anymore. And it doesn't matter if the weather is suddenly really freezing cold for months on end, which is very typical in Scotland, or if it is suddenly swelteringly hot, that cask is going to age at a certain rate and what the flavours will be. The education programmes has went into the master blenders and the master distillers and the warehouse keepers who are continuously going around sampling these casks to find out when they are at their prime. That education ensures that you get that consistency now from the products and the tasting panels and the science that goes into it. Whiskey casks, it's not just 10 people now sitting around the table sampling it, agreeing, oh yeah, that tastes very similar to what it tasted like last year, right? So we'll release that. I've sat there around these tables and the scientific reports that are done on a cask of whiskey before it's bottled, testing for everything, any off flavors, testing for, is it matching the same scientific criteria that it matched last year? And if it does, then great, it makes the cut. And if it doesn't, then we'll send it off for it to be part of a blended whiskey rather than be this amazing single malt, because they're so protective of what is released now and ensuring that they maintain the quality and consistency and a well-balanced product. And I think that is part of what is continuing the rise and the growth of whiskey consumption around the world, attracting new people to the market, because with these great cask programs that they've brought into play, they're able to ensure that when they do do a port barrel, or when they do a sherry barrel, or when the master blenders and distillers come together and actually blend all three barrels together to release something really special, or blend two together, that product is so accessible to everyone across the market that it just keeps drawing in new and new drinkers. And of course, there is education of drinkers also. And the growth of social media has allowed people to be able to do the virtual tastings to find out what a product should or shouldn't taste like before they've even reached for it off the shelf. So that quality control has become so important. And the, as I spoke about earlier on, the sort of the drawing of the curtain to open up the distilleries to people to make it feel like they're part of that journey and part of that distillery continues to bring more and more people sitting around the table enjoying the end product. And that is where it's so different to wine with whiskey, because it is more controlled. You can't open a bottle of wine to see how it's tasting, but with a cask, they can continuously draw samples of year on year on year and make sure that it is aging appropriately, make sure that it is in its absolute prime condition. And with bottles of wine, that's a much harder thing to do. And obviously, you know, wine has its own experts and its own education behind it. But with whiskey, it's so professional, and it is a much more protected way of checking year on year that product is maintaining the highest of conditions for the highest end quality product. If that deals with the question.
Perfectly. This is a question for both of you, but I'll start with you, Pat. To what extent is the value of a cask or a bottle driven by fashion or marketing or sort of taste at the time versus, say, the quality of the contents of the bottle? So the reason I ask is that it seems to me that the wine, there can be these very good vintages that will be exceptionally sought after and highly valued, whereas for I gather from what you're saying about the whiskey, that they make a concerted effort to revive a brand and bring it to everybody's attention, and that seems to be what drives some of the changes in valuation.
That's incredibly correct. There are, you know, as we've touched upon already, there are brands, all single malt whiskey that comes from a main distillery, a distillery that's sat there for, you know, hundreds of years. It's all a great product. And the reason it stood there for hundreds of years is because they have produced a wonderful, great product. Nowadays, they've removed any ambiguity of, you know, maybe having a bad 10%. Yes, fashion, brand managers, designers, you know, chief executives play such a key role in, you know, bringing back a brand, a distillery that's there and it's producing whiskey. And, you know, if you take an example, like a Balmenac or a Royal Bracklow or a Ben Nevis, right? So Ben Nevis, great prime example. So there are, Ben Nevis is owned by Nika, and 70%, give or take, of the liquid the whiskey that Ben Nevis makes actually is shipped across to Japan and goes into Nika whiskey. Now, Nika whiskey is so well regarded, it's a really expensive product to buy. Whereas Ben Nevis, it's in the most beautiful location, the most beautiful setting. It's got such an iconic name that's known worldwide, but yet it doesn't sell worldwide because it has been in a terrible bottle. It is a distillery that before Nika has invested all this money, which they've been doing over the last 2 years, they've been investing heavily in the infrastructure of the distillery. You drive past the distillery now and it is beautiful sitting at the foot of Ben Nevis, whereas beforehand the paint was peeling off, it was a bit tatty, you know, it had an old management team in place from decades beforehand. And Nika have taken this baby, they've grabbed it, and they have made the distillery incredible. They've set up a big viewing platform at the back of the distillery for people to take Instagram pictures of their experience, for example, and tag everyone in it. They've built a beautiful tasting room that is, it's built in granite. It's granite and it's red leather and it's every Ben Nevis thing. And there is a rebrand on the way with Ben Nevis. And I've been lucky enough to sit in the offices of Ben Nevis, see this new rebrand. It looks fantastic. But people have clocked on that Ben Nevis is going through changes. Nika are investing into it. There must be something going on in the background. And the price has started to climb. And now soon the rebrand will be out. There will be different age expressions, different year expressions. And the fashion behind it will change. So instead of 70% of that liquid going to Nika, they'll be pulling back some because they'll need it for themselves to release these different years, these different age expressions. And it is the same with what's happened with Royal Brackla. You know, as I said to you in one of the previous questions, the price of that for a cask nearly doubled overnight, and the price of a bottle for the new expressions they were releasing for ages, that they for age expressions they hadn't released before, and cask finishes they hadn't released before, that was almost 50% higher than some of the comparable older ones. But the older ones didn't have the fancy new label, didn't have all the PR drive behind it. And that doesn't damage the value of pre-existing popular brands. It just means that now there is a huge amount of marketing money suddenly behind this product, bringing it more into the public's consciousness, bringing it more into the public eye, bigger Instagram drives behind that, you know, more traffic online. And that inherently does push up the value of something that was undervalued. And there are still plenty of other brands out there, whiskey brands, that are currently undervalued, that are owned by the Pernod Ricards of the world, the Bacardis, the Diageos, where there is a lot of work going on in the background because there's a hole to fill in the whiskey market. There's more people drinking it than ever. It's growing year on year. There's a demand worldwide, but you can only get single malt whiskey, Scotch, from Scotland. There's only a finite amount of distilleries. And so how do they increase their market share, or how do they reach new territories or make the most of whiskey they're producing already that might previously be used for blend? Well, years of investment into a rebrand, getting different expressions, different wood finishes ready, and then go out there and introduce this new all singing, all dancing rebrand to the world, and the price just climbs up. And it's a simple process, but it probably would never have happened if it wasn't for the bigger worldwide organizations taking over the distilleries and bringing that professionalism. Because beforehand, all prices were almost driven and dictated by the independent bottlers. Because the distilleries, when they were all independently owned, were selling their bottles to all the independent bottlers, your Gordon and McPhail's of the world, your Hunter Langs, your Douglas Langs, and they were so reliant upon that cash flow and that those revenue streams, because it was those independent bottlers that had done the time developing the routes to market globally. With their blended whiskies or their single release expressions, and they determined if they released a 13-year-old Mortlach under Hunter Lang, and that was so popular and was getting rave reviews, then that's what made, you know, Mortlach even more popular and more expensive. And the independent bottlers done a lot of the promotional work for the distilleries. But the minute that you started to get that external investment from the bigger companies with their own marketing teams and their 10-year plans, then that's when it pulled back for the independent bottlers, and you got the smarter approach to the industry because they had the deeper pockets to invest into long-term projects and weren't almost living as hand-to-mouth as they had previously done. And so, yeah, that's that in a nutshell. Yes, fashion does drive it, creativity, the marketing team, rebrands, bringing more people's attention to a previously lesser thought of distillery, does increase the price drastically of that whiskey, but it does not diminish the inherent growth going on with an already popular brand that you can see in the supermarket or see worldwide. I hope that deals with that in a good way.
That was great. But Steve, same question to you, because there was a, I remember
20 years ago, maybe there was a documentary called Mondavino, which was about Robert Parker's influence and perhaps promoting Mondavi as a you know, a comparable sort of wine to some of the European wines as an investment grade wine. And it's sort of the suggestion in that documentary was that it was unfair for him to have sort of promoted it to that point. I guess that's sort of that's an example of fashion, but I don't know, maybe it was just an undiscovered wine. Do you have any views?
I think where wine varies is different to the whiskey side, of course, as Pat touched on, sort of rebrands and sort of people looking at sort of changing the path and the direction of different whiskey brands. I think with wine and the fact that we touched base on earlier, Appellation Contrôlée, and the amount of wine they can produce each year, and the fact of that you've also got the growth system in place, the growth system hasn't changed. It hasn't changed. It changed once over 100 years ago, and it's pretty much sat and where it is now. So I think it's almost like these chateaus have their stance already. You know the likes of the Lafite Rothschilds, you know the likes of Mouton Rothschilds, and you know that they're at the pinnacle. They know how good they are. There is no difference in the wine labels from one year to the other. It literally just has the vintage on the bottle. There is no change. It's just a matter of them having to focus and be as on point as possible as actually producing the superb wines that they do every single year. So I wouldn't say that there's any real influence on fashion at all. More so maybe on the champagne side of things, where you have different fads with champagnes, or the sort of celebrities drinking certain champagnes, and that might put them in the spotlight, the public eye. But I think with the big hitting wines, they are really, really high, and the kudos is there. They know where they are. There's only a certain amount of people could afford to drink sort of your Latours, say, for example, where there might be £500 within a restaurant, £1,000 a bottle. There's only a small amount of the higher net worth sort of people that would be able to drink this sort of these wines in your bars and restaurants. So I don't think there's much real influence. I just think these chateaus, these vineyards have set their stamp from day one. You will get other chateaus that are up and coming through the ropes. Like you said, you have, there's an influence maybe with Robert Parker, but Robert Parker can make or break a chateau. So of course, if there's been mentions of certain wines, then maybe there was a little backhand or a brown envelope with a certain amount of money that was given out to promote this new wine. But like I said, I think a lot of them have their stance already, and that there isn't any real influence from elsewhere.
If I was to approach you and say, I'm interested in investing in investment grade wine, I like the idea, or in fine wine, I like the idea of, you know, being able to drink some of it for free by selling the rest of it at some point, what would you tell me to do? Should I put together a portfolio? What should I be thinking about?
Well, I think because of the foundations of Bordeaux and how well it's done over time, we predominantly say to a client, a collector, look, let's focus 50% of them funds over into Bordeaux, not necessarily having to be first growth wines. There's some fantastic wines from sort of second growth wines, even down to your fifth growth. There's still some fantastic wines like Ponte Canet. It's a fifth growth wine, but in 2009, the Ponte Canet was given 100 points out of 100 by Robert Parker. Once again in 2010, and they've shown good growth, but they have now slowed down. But they're the sort of wines where you might pick up a case for, say, sort of £1,700-1,800 a case, and it gives us a bit of diversification. We would say to a customer, maybe focus sort of 10% of funds after that on Burgundies, 10% on Rhone. There's some absolutely fantastic wines, Sassicaia from Italy. You got some super Tuscans, Italy, Sassicaia, Ornellaia. They've done really, really well over the last few years. Like, people have made fantastic growth, percentage growth. But we just try to be as diverse as possible. We know that Bordeaux is the base, it's the foundation. So we'd probably focus 50% Bordeaux, 10% Champagne, 10% Rhone, 10% California. This, like I said, some great Californian wines, very quirky, different, but haven't shown us the growth that we would like to see as of yet. But we would recommend anyone look at, even if, wine or whiskey, a sort of 5-year hold, a 10-year hold. It's not something where we don't see any fluctuation, you see. It's not where we have the global pandemic and there's billions of pounds wiped off the stock market. Suddenly, it's we just don't see any affiliation with global pandemics. If there's changing presidents or and literally we have, it's, things can be volatile, and I think that's what people like with investing or collecting in wine and whiskey, that it just literally stays steady, and the longer you hold, the better you're going to do. We might show people sort of 5% growth 1 year, but 15-20% growth on another year. It's very, very rarely, if we, and I think it's something that we pride ourselves on between myself, Pat, and the guys at Elite Wine and Whiskey, where we don't rush into investing people's money. So if someone comes to us and says, look, this is how much I want to put into the market, this is, we work with the customer. So they have an interest in the product. They might give us an influence of where they want to put their money as well. It might be more whiskey based if they have some sort of influence or some family heritage or some background where they want to invest more in whiskey. But we would take our time, and we always take our time making sure that the stock that we put any of our customers to, we know it's going to perform well over a certain amount of time, a certain amount of years. But we recommend sort of 5-year hold at least, anywhere up to 10 really, if possible.
Yes, yeah, same question to you. If I was to approach you and say I want to invest in whiskey, what should I do? Should I build a portfolio, and what should I be thinking about as I'm doing that?
You should 100% build a portfolio. The main things to consider, you want to be investing in a whiskey that is predominantly owned by one or all of the major international companies, Diageo, Bacardi, Pernod Ricard, somebody of that nature, that if they're putting all their money into that distillery, into that business, that's obviously a really good thing for your investment, because they're going to see the uplift in the whiskey and the distillery. That's going to represent an uplift in the cask that's going to outperform the standard year-on-year increase. You would want a diversity in terms of the year expressions. So you might get a 3-year-old cask, a 5-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 15-year-old cask, so that then you can be getting different growth at different stages. And of course, if you were really wanting to expand upon that portfolio, you would also be wanting to look for different cask expressions. So from refill bourbon to sherry to port. And then you've basically ticked every single box. You know, you only want to be buying whiskies that you can see in every major supermarket or duty-free across the world, because then, you know, you're really maximizing it. There are whiskies out there that are trade name spirit. So that is a secondary whiskey that the distillery would produce. So Tomatin, for example, is the main name distillery. They'll produce a Tomatin whiskey. But they have a trade name spirit called Strathairn, which is what goes out to blenders. And some people are misguided or misknowingly invest into these trade name spirits without doing the research properly, and therefore are then with a cask, but there's no overall brand behind that particular cask. And that's why it's really important to just invest into main name brand whiskies that you can see on the shelves, and that you can Google and that you can see on websites like, you know, the Whiskey Exchange or Masters of Malt, the big main name players, and because that gives you the safety and security. You know, somebody else is working hard investing their billions and millions of pounds into building that brand, which you own a cask of. So let them do all the hard work for you whilst you just let it sit there and continue to mature into this wonderful, beautiful spirit. And if you did ever want to draw off a bottle from your cask, you can do that without affecting any part of your profit, because your cask is sitting safely in a nice HMRC bonded warehouse with your unique cask number, which is the same as a license plate on a car. So it's unique to you, and you can get the warehouse keeper or somebody that works within the warehouse to draw off a bottle of the whiskey from your cask. Obviously, if you do it when it's too young, it'll be at 60% ABV. So, you know, it might destroy your taste buds and destroy your palate forever. But as time goes on, or if you have a 15-year-old cask, For example, you could draw off a bottle, they'll stick your name, your label, all the cast details on the bottle for you, and they can be sitting there pride of place, you know, in your home, on your drinks tray, your drinks cabinet, sharing with your friends. And then a couple of years later, you can draw off another bottle and have a comparison as it's mellowed out a bit and more of the flavors from the cask have came into it. But that's number one for me, is you want a cask of whiskey from a main name brand distillery that you can see everywhere, then followed by the different age expressions and then the different cask styles. And that gives you such a great level of potential growth and protection, because we're a big company doing all that hard work for you. You know, you're just going to reap the rewards of that from what they do.
Gents, absolutely fascinating discussion. We're coming up on time. If folks are interested in learning more about wine or whiskey or getting in touch with you, what's the best way to go about doing that?
So our website is www.elitewineandwhiskey.com. Our telephone number and all our details, contact details are on there. We have a team of portfolio managers that are happy to answer any questions. If anyone ever wants to call in or speak to us, and me and Pat were always at the other end of the phone as well. So, and as you can tell from today's conversation, we enjoy drinking and talking wine and whiskey. So if anyone ever wants to call us and they want any advice, then by all means, yeah, we're here.
Well, that's fantastic. Thanks very much, Steve Bishop and Patrick Fisher from Elite Wine and Whiskey. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.